Dave Fanning on 2FM.
Just a couple of weeks back, one of pop artist Andy Warhol's portraits of Marilyn Monroe reached a record sales figure of $195 million at auction, making it the most expensive artwork of the 20th century ever sold. The artist himself, Andy Warhol, is also the subject of a Netflix TV series called The Andy Warhol Diaries, based on his own diaries, which he published in a book back in 1989. So who was Andy Warhol? And why exactly do his artworks sell for such high prices? Well, to answer these questions, hopefully, I'm joined now by lecturer in visual culture, Dr. Linda King of the Institute of Art, Design and Technology in Dunleary in Dublin. Linda, how are you doing? Are you all right?
I'm good, Dave. How are you?
I'm very good indeed. My summer is going brilliantly. Thank you very much.
Good. Oh,
just looking out the window there. Yeah, looking a bit dull again, but then again, it's been like that most of the time. So listen, let's have a look at what we're doing here. The artwork. What did I call it earlier? I mean, is it a screen print? Is it a portrait? Is it a painting? What was the artwork that actually sold for nearly $200 million?
The name of it is Shot Sage Blue Marilyn. What he did was he screen printed onto canvas and then painted over it. So it's part screen print, part painting.
And it's not the only one, is it? He's got a bunch of those, doesn't he?
Yeah, he did a series of them. This is from 1964, but he started working on images, the same image of Marilyn Monroe in 1962, the year that she died. So his first one, I think it's his first one, is the Gold Marilyn, which is in the Museum of Modern Art, where it's a small image of her. It's this iconic image that was taken from Niagara, her breakout film in 1953. And he used that image multiple times. So it wasn't the first time he screen printed this particular image, because he had an absolute fascination with Marilyn Monroe. Mm. And the reference to Shot is because another artist.
Yeah, it's a great story. Is that a really true? Is it the story you're going to tell me? Is it really true?
Apparently. So she shot at the painting. She came up to the factory, his studio space and his hangout space, and shot it. So
it seems she actually went up to him and said, "Do you mind if I shoot these?" He says, "No," thinking she was going to take out a camera. She took out a gun.
She did, yeah. And it wasn't the first time he had been, well, this time the painting was shot at, but he'd actually been shot himself by Val Solanas back in 1968. So, I mean, the factory space where he worked, which was a studio and this hangout space for, you know, various people, including Lou Reed and the Velvet Underground and various other characters of the New York art scene, it did attract quite a lot of drama from time to time by nature of the people who hung out there. So the title of the painting, Shot Sage Blue Marilyn, is a reference to, you know, the painting's history, that it was damaged at one point, and the sage refers to the background colour. He did a few versions of this in different colours.
Right. Okay, so why Marilyn Monroe and why this image? I mean, he had an ongoing obsession, didn't he, with celebrity culture?
He did, and particularly women, and also the themes of death. And I think this portrait combines both of those themes. And I actually find it quite affecting, because 1953, not only did Niagara come out, but also Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, How to Marry a Millionaire. And so in 1953, she was the most famous woman in the world, or one of the most famous people in the world. And that this portrait, you know, captures that idea. But I think the tragedy of Marilyn Monroe's life struck a really deep chord with Warhol, because by the standards of the day, she seemed to have everything. She was so successful. She was so beautiful. She'd been, you know, was married to Arthur Miller. She was possibly the mistress of JFK. But ultimately, she was deeply unhappy and died alone from an overdose at at the age of 36. So for me, I interpret this as a portrait, this portrait as a metaphor for the American dream, that anyone can be rich and famous, but ultimately that doesn't bring happiness. And I think that really struck a very deep chord with Warhol himself, because for all his fame and for all his, you know, celebrity, again, that didn't bring him happiness either. So I think she just, this image of Marilyn struck a really, really deep chord with him.
Yeah, he was a bit of a miserable outsider, but I mean, he was the first to admit that. So he hated everything about himself, the way he looked, his skin, his hair, everything. So all of that then, I mean, like, did you see a version of this at the Brooklyn Museum in December?
Yeah, I was lucky enough to be over, Easter time. I'm forgetting my own. Travel is all a bit of a blur at the moment, as is time. But yeah, there was a big exhibition that just finished there last week, I think it was, in the Brooklyn Museum, called Revelation. And it looked at the themes of death and religion in Warhol's art. And again, it was very, you know, very affecting, and it really explored his background as an Orthodox Catholic from Slovakia. I mean, his original name was Andrew Warhola, though he was born in Pittsburgh to immigrants. But he was brought to mass, I think, on an almost daily basis. The iconography or the imagery within that church is very much, there's lots of gold, like early Renaissance paintings. And they did make that point that this really trickled through his work. And then as the AIDS crisis evolved in the 1980s, and he became more and more uncomfortable with his homosexuality, which is what the Andy Warhol Diaries explores, he starts looking at more themes of death, including the Last Supper. He did massive big screen prints of the Last Supper. He went to see the Pope in Rome, and religion and death became a recurring theme in his work very, very strongly. So not that he'd moved away from the celebrity aspect, but just there was a sense, I think, of his own mortality. And because he'd been shot and nearly killed in 1968, and he was still quite ill as a result of that. I mean, the TV series shows images of his chest, which is totally carved up. Yeah. I mean, it's really...
Incidentally, have you seen the Netflix 5-part series? I've seen 3 of them. I've 2 more to go. It's very good.
It is. And I think, you know, Warhol, it's hard to bring something new to Warhol, but I think that actually does. And it's based on his diaries, which were published after his death and edited by one of his close friends, Pat Hackett. And for me, it did explore new themes that I hadn't already been, you know, very familiar with. And the executive producer is Ryan Murphy. So Glee, American Horror Story, it has a slickness to it and a very strong narrative, which, again, is very engaging. And it's a checklist of celebrities, current celebrities as well. I mean, Debbie Harry is featured, Fab Five Freddy is in there, Rob Lowe. It's a fascinating exploration.
And did he know something about celebrity that, you know, was in some ways, like, you know, prophetic? And so, like, I mean, are you going to tell me that he kind of, you could actually say he nearly invented Instagram?
Well, he said that in the future, everybody would have 15 minutes of fame. Now, he's not supposed to be the first person who said that, but he certainly...
What? You know, oh, God, I thought he was. Oh, my God.
Yeah. Well, you see, this is the thing about Warhol, a bit like, you know, Bowie, a bit like...
Oh, he knows how to steal. Yeah, no question.
Yeah, and he knows how to capitalize on whatever is the current...
You know, it's funny, because somebody put him once, I don't know if it's in that series, but I saw it somewhere that he understood culture in a huge way, to the point where it was like somebody watching a game of football. He understands more about the game of football than anybody else in the whole ground, but he can't play and he's no good at it and he's jealous of those who do, but he still knows more than they all do. That's the kind of thing he does.
He's a huge strategist.
So his artworks frequently sell for record sums, don't they? I mean, Andy Warhol is nearly as big today, probably as big today as he ever was.
Bigger, you know, back in, even in the 1980s, he struggled to be accepted as part of the established art world. And a lot of contemporary artists looked down their noses at him. Like I suppose they found him a little bit trashy because of his, you know, unapologetic interest in celebrity culture and courting celebrities and being part of that whole scene. So I think what the program does is very well. It just shows his desperation to be part of that world. And, you know, I suppose he would have equated the amount that his work now fetches with success, which, again, is very vacuous and, you know, a little bit tragic, you know, in a way. Like, he needed that validation in order to feel good about himself.
And there have been 2 major retrospectives of his work in New York City just in the last few years, haven't there?
Yes, which shows just how endlessly, you know, popular he is. So there was a big one in the Whitney in 2019, and then the one that has just finished in the Brooklyn a couple of weeks ago. And then there was a big one in IMA, in our own Irish Museum of Modern Art, back in 1997, which was hugely popular as well. So I think he's always going to be popular. He's always going to attract those blockbuster
shows. Okay, well then,
shows.
Hold on a second. Let's get deep into it here now. And a lecturer in visual culture, Dr. Linda King of the Institute of Art, Design and Technology in Dún Laoghaire in Dublin. Why does he fetch such figures?
Well, I think people obviously buy for investment reasons because they know that that work is going to be, resellable. But I think that's different to why the public like him. I mean, I think from a public perspective, he's accessible. So when you see those Campbell soup cans blown up large or those Brillo pad boxes or Marilyn Monroe, there's an instancy of recognition that you latch onto. So contemporary American or 20th century American culture, you know, you can relate to it. But there's, if you dig down into it, then there's those themes of celebrity and particularly death and comments on consumer culture as well. And he draws attention to objects that we probably don't even notice. So even taking that Campbell soup can and drawing it up, you know, blowing it up large and multiplying it forces us to think about consumerism and things and fast food and how that has become so much part of our contemporary life. So I think for me, I mean, what differentiates good art from bad art? I mean, good art encourages you to reflect on the world and think about it a bit differently. And I think that's what Warhol does.
OK, well, then, I mean, even if people would say that he's just a very popular interpreter of commerce and celebrates gaudy and vulgar iconographies and all the rest of that, that's like, I mean, you know, the point about it is he's quite conceptual, I suppose. And that's what pop art was all about, wasn't it?
It was. I mean, it shifted quite radically. And actually, pop art began in London in 1956 with artists like Richard Hamilton, who started critiquing contemporary culture. And, you know, it just, I suppose pop art drew attention again to the minutiae of everyday life and forced people to look at it in a different way and shifted things away from the craft of making. You didn't have to be the best painter. You didn't have to be the best sculptor. But the ideas were what were important. And the ideas are what make you, I suppose, reflect on the world differently.
And the fact that he created multiples of his work, I mean, sometimes other people did it for him, if you like. Is it just an extension of what he kind of was, if you like?
Yeah, again, drawing attention to that idea of mass production and how mass production permeates contemporary society.
Well, then, hold on a second. Mass production, let's go straight to it. What was the factory?
Well, the factory was actually, well, it was this working space and his kind of hangout space. And as I said, you know, everybody kind of hung out there at one point. But it wasn't one space. It was several different spaces that moved around New York. So some of them were industrial spaces. So the word factory was applicable to what the buildings looked like. But also because he was directing people to make his work, particularly screen prints, there was the idea of the factory production line, which it referenced as well. So, the factory was, I mean, Lou Reed wrote about the factory. Walk on the Wild Side is a name check of people who hung out there, like Holly, Jackie, Little Joe, Sugar Plum Fairy. They were all there hanging out, making films, making art, taking drugs, or just doing whatever.
He had a TV show, didn't he? His own show.
He did. Yeah, he had his own show on cable TV where he would interview, I suppose, the people that he hung out with, but you know, people like Debbie Harry would have featured on it. So that was, you know, another way of connecting with multiple audiences. I mean, he was so shrewd at being able to manipulate media. It didn't matter what the medium was, whether it was TV, whether it was painting, whether it was printmaking, whether it was music. I mean, you know, he designed the front cover for the first Velvet Underground album, the iconic banana, and put his name on it, Andy Warhol. There is the title of the band isn't there at all until you open the gatefold sleeve. But he just had an absolute knack, like Bowie, for being able to manipulate media.
As part of the door that he might have opened, do you think that Malcolm McLaren, New York Dolls onto Sex Pistols mightn't have happened without that door being opened?
Well, definitely, I think he was the blueprint for McLaren. And if you think of McLaren's back catalogue coming from fashion into music and producing, I mean, you know, that idea of the Svengali that's, you know, manipulating everybody and everything. I mean, definitely he's the blueprint for that.
You know, I'm sure he would have liked the money, but would he have been comfortable in himself with the idea that his art was achieving such high prices at auctions?
I think he would.
Yeah, I think he would have equated that with success. But, you know, ultimately, as we've discussed, it didn't bring him happiness. And, you know, particularly when it gets into, as the TV series looks at, particularly when he gets into the 1980s and the background of the AIDS crisis. And, you know, he was never particularly comfortable with the sexuality, is what the TV programme puts across. But when the AIDS crisis happened, you know, he really starts to retreat and gets very, very anxious and kind of pull up the drawbridge around him. So ultimately, the money didn't make him happy.
Yeah, I mean, the album you mentioned, The Velvet Underground and Nico, is looked upon as being like a seminal album, really important album and really great. It is seminal. It is important and it really is great. But the thing is, the sales, it's hardly sold at all, 30,000 or something. And the famous quote from Brian Eno that those people know, the 30,000 copies were sold of The Velvet Underground album in the early years, and everyone who bought one of those 30,000 copies started a band. It's true. Later on, by the way, the late 60s, he did the famous Rolling Stones cover, didn't he?
Yes, Sticky Fingers for the Rolling Stones with the zip. And yeah. I mean, and the original, I mean, and that's kind of really interesting, the idea of an album cover being interactive with the zip. But also the original Velvet Underground album, you could peel off the yellow banana yeah. to reveal a pink banana underneath, which was quite provocative.
Right, indeed. No, the Rolling Stones one, though, was a pain in the neck, because if you had all your albums stacked up, it used to tear the back of the other album, you know. Okay, so then finally, the Andy Warhol Diaries, in which the TV series is based. First of all, does anybody write diaries anymore? Because if they don't, they should.
I think Instagram has become the new
yeah, you see, that's
form
the problem.
Of diaries.
It's not the same thing.
Yeah, no, it's yeah, not. It's not yeah. the same thing. But I think if he was alive today, and he was only 58 when he died, and I was actually quite surprised to be, you know, to be reminded of that watching the TV series. I actually thought he was much older, because he seemed to do so much. But I think if he were alive today, he would be all over Instagram, and maybe more so than Twitter, because Instagram is a visual medium. So I think he would be using that as a way of obviously promoting himself, but also part diary.
Yeah, I mean, he did say at one stage, I'm a gay Catholic who thinks he's a freak, and in fact, I know I'm a freak, or something along those lines. Do you think, kind of sad, he could never be, I mean, he was completely outré in terms of his sexuality, but not really. The Catholic background got in the way, did it?
It seemed to, yeah, and certainly that's what the exhibition in the Brooklyn Museum puts across, that he, what you know, his own Catholicism was a restraining force, but also an inspirational force to him. And actually looking around that exhibition, I suppose that the curators of that particular exhibition kind of saw this as revelationary, hence the word revelation. But I think for me, looking at it as somebody who was brought up Catholic in Ireland, you could kind of see the themes. It's familiar to you. You know, it's not so revelationary.
Okay, Linda, give us your favourite Andy Warhol quote, will you?
Well, I think this is kind of a bit of the moment, because we're all beginning to, you know, travel, and I'm just back from traveling, and it's not a pleasant experience at the moment. But right. He loved airplanes and he loved airports, and he said, "Today my favorite kind of atmosphere is the airport atmosphere. I'm embarrassed to say I don't like to fly, because I love to be modern, but I compensate by loving airports and airplanes so much."
It's not what the stars usually say. Listen, Linda, thank you so much for being with us in the program once again.
Dave Fanning on 2FM.